They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right. Well, welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming out for this third stop on the podcast tour. I was in Boston on Wednesday. D.C., yeah, there you go. I'll say this.
Say it louder.
This is the most optimistic crowd of the ones I've been to. You know, Boston, they're a little bit, a little jaded from last season. D.C., I don't know what they are at this point. But this crowd's got some optimism, and rightfully so. I want to introduce my panel here. She's in her eighth season with the Nets, the last three as the game analyst. Also does a great job covering the NBA nationally with FS1, Sarah Kustak.
Hey, everyone. Good to see all of you here.
And he is Brooklyn's own, at least he goes there now, senior writer with Bleacher Report, formerly the Knicks beat writer of the New York Times, Howard Beck. And she is in her second year covering the league for ESPN, recently relocated to New York again to cover the Nets, returned to where she used to cover sports, the New York Times, Malik Andrews. And a little bit later on, we're going to get Sean Marks, the general manager of the Nets, is going to come up here and tell you all about this offseason from his perspective. But Sarah, I want to use kind of one of those old writing devices here and say, back in 2016, if I told you this is where you'd be right now, at the end of a 21-win season, new general manager, new coach, what would you have said?
I don't want to say that I wouldn't believe you, but I do think it's been an extraordinary journey getting to this point, because I think all of us, and Howard was here when this Brooklyn Nets team first came to Barclays and moved here, and I think we've seen the highs and lows, the big expectations of the Nets move to Brooklyn, the big expectations that came in that second year with Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, Jason Kidd as the head coach, and then there was a drop off. And so to see what Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson have come in and done, and it's been a collective whole, and they've made certain to share the credit, because they said it's not just about them, but it is about their vision and the type of players that they brought in. And culture is such a buzzword in the NBA, and I know Howard can speak to this, seeing so many different ones, but the infrastructure that was built, we're now seeing that pay dividends. And there's so many players who I know we've all talked to, whether it's Kevin, whether it's Kyrie, some of the others, but they have said, we saw what Brooklyn was slowly building and how they played and what they did on a daily basis. And I think it was that attention to detail that got them to this point in a quicker manner than I think any of us could have anticipated.
Howard, same question. What do you think?
Before we get to that, because you did introduce me as Brooklyn's own, and because we have to properly welcome you to Brooklyn, Chris, I picked up some kale for you.
Oh, nice. Kale. Great.
Aren't there bakeries in Brooklyn?
For the long flight home.
There are kale chips. Yeah, so I didn't want to just plain kale.
Cheesecake, maybe? Like, there are other cooler things in Brooklyn.
I know you're jealous.
There we go.
You're
Mannix,
jealous of the kale.
You should lay off the cheesecake,
eat the kale chips.
Shots fired.
You're also, okay. Well, go ahead. You're bringing props to a podcast. That's interesting. Continue.
No, I mean, Sarah put it well, and if you roll back even further to when the Nets first got to Brooklyn, and there was this whole push to say, like, we need to own New York from day one. We got to knock the Knicks off. We got to go in with, you know, guns blazing and stars on the roster, and it pushed them into kind of an untenable position, which we you know, you learn as you go, and maybe they should have seen that coming, but they did it the wrong way. They should have come in building it organically. And with the reset happening, once Sean and Kenny take over, and there's, you know, it was a forced reset. It was a crash and burn kind of reset, but still, it forced a reevaluation all the way to the top of the organization. And they thought, you know, they had to reassess. And they did it smartly. They said, well, this didn't work. Just throwing a bunch of money at a bunch of players who kind of look like all stars, but don't really necessarily play at a franchise star level, it didn't work. They had to tear it down to the studs. They did it right. They were smart about using cap room to pick up players on bad contracts so that they could then get picks and then use those picks to flip in other deals. And it just got built organically. But even still, we could all say, well, you're making the right moves, the smart moves, maybe the only moves that could have made. You still couldn't have seen coming what happened, which was every year overachieving, finding these hidden gems like Joe Harris and Spencer Dinwiddie, finding these, you know, late first picks who blossomed under your watch, Jared Allen, Caris LeVert. Like, they made some really good bets, and they developed guys. And when we talk about culture, like, that's it. Like, guys come here and they get better, whether they were, you know, cast-offs or whether they were just, you know, mid-career. Everybody comes here, gets better. That speaks really well of what they built. And then the ultimate payoff becomes KD and Kyrie. But I would just say, even if that hadn't happened this summer, it doesn't change the fact that they've been doing the right things to put them on this kind of path.
And I think, not to jump in, but you mentioned two guys.
But to jump in, yes.
I'm going to. Spencer Dinwiddie and Joe Harris. I mean, these are two players that were essentially out of the league. They scoop up Spencer Dinwiddie from the G League. He was playing with the Windy City Bulls. Joe Harris, you know, was with Cleveland. He got waived. These are players that, you know, in a different circumstance, may not be playing out here. I think both of them, you know, their personalities and their work ethic, they would probably find their way back. But now they are premier players and starters in the NBA. And so I think that just speaks to the identification of, okay, what type of not only talent are we looking for, but character that we're finding in these guys that will help bring the other players in.
Okay, Malik, I'm buying all that, but there's also an element of luck to all this. I mean, Howard, you sang an aria there about how, you know, well they did with some of these trades, but
people love my singing.
It's just, I mean, there were some things they got lucky that didn't happen, right? I mean, what if the Heat didn't match Tyler Johnson's contract?
Right.
What if Washington didn't match Otto Porter? I thought they dodged a bullet with the Allen Crabbe contract, and then they went out and traded for it again. So, I mean, like, there's an element of that.
There is an element of luck, but, you know, those things tend to go hand in hand. You have to be good to get lucky sometimes, and that's what it seems like happened to me with Brooklyn. And now the question becomes, okay, this culture that they have worked so hard to build, can they absorb players who have had sometimes turbulent pasts when it comes to culture? I'm looking at Kyrie in Boston. Is that culture strong enough to absorb a player who's had his ups and downs like that? And Sean Marks is basically looking at this and saying, yeah, that's the bet we're going to take. And so that's a really strong position to be in. But yeah, sure. I mean, there is an element of luck that goes with that as well. And also, I think, you know, if the Knicks had gotten the number one pick and we're looking at Zion in you know, in New York, and what would that have done to different decisions? There's a whole lot of things that shook out this summer, including Zion ending up being in New Orleans.
One thing, Sarah, that I learned over the summer that I didn't really know enough about was the talk about the culture, just how involved Sean Marks has decided to make families in all this. And Kyrie kind of talked about this. And sometimes players just say that stuff and say, well, you know, it's nice how they treated my wife or treated my kids. But, you know, I know I talked to Jared Dudley about this and other Nets players about this, Damari Carroll over the summer about this. It's different here than it is in other places. That's something that Sean took from San Antonio. And, you know, sometimes you think in basketball, it's just about the money. It's like, well, I can get the biggest contract. I want to play in the biggest city. But how they treat players is something, I don't know if it's unique, but it's certainly rare in the NBA.
Well, and I think there's a difference between saying it or guys talking about things being a family and actually feeling that way. And I think Sean did bring that. That was something he experienced in San Antonio, that players always come first. And it's not just about helping the player be in the best possible condition or taking care of them with what they're doing on the court, but understanding taking care of their family in turn helps relieve a lot of stress from them. So
Absolutely.
Whether it's helping with the kids, allowing them to always be around at the facility when needed, sending care packages, having different events when players are away or on the road for a lot of the wives or girlfriends. But there is an attention to detail to making sure that everything is always around what's needed, what helps, take as much off their plate so when they need to focus on basketball, that's what it's about.
All right, let me put it to the audience real quick. By reaction, how many people here are excited about Kevin Durant? How many people are excited about Kyrie Irving?
Yeah.
All right, that was about the same. I'm just curious.
Maybe
because
Kyrie was a hair higher. And then Kyrie might have been a hair louder, but that's just he's playing this season, right? And Kevin's going to be out all season. That was the change in
that
pitch.
That could have something to do
with it. Okay, all right.
But Malika, I had a coach tell me recently that Kyrie Irving is no longer the guy that made that shot against Golden State. He is now the guy that bleaked up Boston. Like, that's kind of what his reputation has become. So he comes into this situation. If you look at all the players in the league with pressure, like, he's one of the top three guys. I mean, this may not be a championship season because KD's not there, but it can't it can't be a redux of what happened in Boston, can it?
No. I mean, it can't. I don't know that I would agree with the assessment that Kyrie is no longer that player that he was who made that shot. But I also think that we're talking about two different things. That's an on-court ability.
I guess more known for is what the coach is
saying. Sure. Okay. That actually might be true, but there also may be a little bit of a recency bias. And Kyrie got up in front of all of us on Media Day, and he said, look, I knew I was a crappy leader in Boston. I had some personal things going on off the court, and that's fine. Everyone is allowed to have that. It really seems like he's come in here knowing that that's something that's following him. Now, whether or not it's kind of he's the shiny new piece of this team and that's going to last remains to be seen. But from the guys I've talked to in the locker room, he's been reaching out behind the scenes. He's been showing up to workouts. He's been being helpful in practice. Now, right now, maybe that's a little easier than when the going gets tough and if a loss happens or if injuries happen or whatever may be the case. But I do think that there is an element of, okay, Kyrie needs to come in here and be a leader, and he knows it. And the front office has told him this. The coaching staff has told him this. His teammates know that that's the case. But going back to what we were talking about earlier, this is a team, if any team can absorb that kind of a player, it should be a team like this, where there's an abundance of good guys on this team.
Okay, but why is that different than what Boston was the last couple of years? Because you did have, I mean, you had some volatile guys, maybe.
Sarah's just like chomping at the bit.
We'll get Howard in here eventually.
I'm so fortunate to be on your podcast so often. but we talk about this all the time, and I think until you are entrenched and embedded around a team, you don't understand the you can look at players like their cardboard cutouts of, oh, this player is similar to this guy. It's not the same. Terry Rozier is not the same person as Spencer Dinwiddie. Joe Harris is not the same as Marcus Smart. Caris LeVert is not the same personality as Jason Tatum, and that's not a knock, and that's not saying good or bad on any player, but the composition of these teams to me are entirely different, and where these players are at in terms of their careers, with the Caris LeVert just signing the extension, the comfort he has with this team, him being looked upon as a leader. Joe Harris, same deal for his situation. Spencer Dinwiddie being one of the major factors in wanting his good friend Kyrie Irving to come play. And he's the backup point guard. He's essentially the backup to Kyrie Irving. I think Kenny Atkinson and Brad Stevens, who both of them you have the utmost respect for, but I think they have very different styles and how they resonate with players. So to me, I think in many cases, for as much as from the outside, these look like similar organizations and similar teams, I think it's you're comparing apples to oranges. And I think the major factor that you cannot overlook is Kyrie chose to be here. This was his decision. He knew what he was getting into, and it's his choice of where he wanted to play.
I would also just say that we should never forget, like, the context of where Boston was. Mm-hmm. So year one with Kyrie, they were fine. There was no sense that there was any tension there or anything else. Now he missed the playoffs and everything else. They do all that, you know, they succeed without him or get all the way to the seventh game of the conference finals. But coming back, and this introduces all these other factors, right? Like, it may well be that around the league people see Kyrie as having ruined Boston. It may well be around the league that people see Kyrie as being that guy instead of the guy who made the game-winning shot or championship-winning shot a few years back. That may well be. That's image. But the reality is, and you know this as well as anyone being around that team all the time, Boston had at least five different things you could point to that went awry last year. From Gordon Hayward coming back, not being himself yet, but him kind of being still force-fed minutes and role, to Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum wanting to take that next step, Terry Rozier wanting to take the next step, guys who were the reason for that postseason success the prior spring, they all wanted to still be those guys. And all of a sudden, Kyrie and Gordon Hayward are back in there. And then on top of that, you know, Kyrie's leadership style or his approach did not work. Now, to Malika's point about players here all saying that Kyrie's saying all the right things, This time last year, I was in your town talking to Kyrie, doing a big feature on him, and Rozier, Al Horford, everybody was telling me about all the different, and this wasn't just platitudes. They were giving me chapter and verse on the things that Kyrie was doing to be a strong leader and a good all-around guy there. Yeah. So at the beginning of the year, there was certainly no indication or hint that things were going to go the way they did. It's just the way that team unfolded from him to Gordon Hayward to all of it.
Well, and I will say the one, I completely agree with what Sarah said about, you know, each individual player. There's obviously some stark differences there. One kind of just large sweeping similarity, though, is you do have young players who have gotten a lot of time on the floor, who have been this young and scrappy team that's kind of clawed their way. They have the we go hard identity. And there's going to be some shuffling now. And how players respond to that is just, I mean, how Kyrie responds to them, but how all those other players respond to their roles changing is going to dictate a lot of how this team goes. And so, like what Sarah was saying, you know, Terry Rozier, he made it very clear that he did not want to be that backup. He thought that, you know, I locked down Eric Bledsoe in the playoffs and therefore I should be, have a bigger role on this team.
But he said all the right things before the season, like right when the season
That's
ends,
true.
This is Kyrie's team.
So right.
It's Kyrie's team. I'm his backup. We'll go at it in practice. Like we,
and then things started to shake out, and it didn't go as smoothly as they necessarily could have. So I do think there's going to be a little bit of that, too. If some of the young guys who've had a very large role who potentially could be asked to take a little bit of a step back this year say, all right, and are genuinely cool with that, then you could potentially have a little bit smoother sailing.
But also, Jalen Brown, Jason Tatum. That will always screw me up. Jalen Brown, Jason Tatum. These are guys who were young, on the rookie contracts, and potential stars or all-stars in this league, and who have not gotten paid yet, and who have really high ceilings.
Yep.
No offense to any of the people on this roster, on any of the guys on this roster who are coming back from last season. They're all kind of at or near their ceilings, probably, aside from, say, Caris LeVert. But LeVert just got extended, and Spencer already had gotten extended. So there's it's a different set of expectations. And need to feel like they have to perform at a high level, right? Brown and Tatum needed to keep going and become the stars that they think they're going to be, in part based on their youth, in part based on where they were drafted. That's not the case with anybody here. So I think it should be a more seamless fit than with Boston.
Well, then Sarah, who's the player then that has to make or is going to have to make the biggest adjustment? Because you know, there's a lot of comparisons with Kyrie kind of plays like D'Angelo, ball dominant type
see,
of guard.
I would say, sorry, I keep cutting you off.
You do that. It's like, you know, you're like Scal in Boston.
All right, Sarah, we appreciate your voice more.
Scal's doing that. This is what I'll say, and I understand I have a little bit of a different lens looking at this, covering the team and being around the team. But to me, when we talk about players making an adjustment, and that's why I do think great points about the differences with Boston, you're losing a high volume, high usage rate player in D'Angelo Russell. So the players that shots are taken away from, touches are taken away from, how you're utilizing a player, you had a player doing those things in D'Angelo Russell who's no longer there. So looking for how are you going to find shots, who are you taking away from? Well, that's the guy. And I find them to be extremely different players in both supremely talented that we see in Kyrie Irving, but he's a downhill player, and he's got a career 39% shooting percentage from the three-point. Like, he's a knockdown three-point shooter. He can get to the basket. We know how he finishes, all of those things. But D'Angelo Russell had a much more savvy game of working the mid-range. We know he used the pick and roll so much because it was less about the explosion of his first step. So I think that Caris LeVert will benefit from that. Joe Harris will benefit from that. Jared Allen will be able to benefit from that because of Kyrie's ability to get the rim, but also stretch the floor. And we'll all miss D'Angelo Russell. I'm a huge fan of him. I think he's going to be tremendous in Golden State, but I think that they're in many ways two different types of point guards. But I do think the usage rate and the volume of shooting that D'Angelo Russell got, a lot of that then will just by nature go to Kyrie.
Well, and I know no one here forgot that when D'Angelo Russell first came here, he was sort of one of those, oh, what's going to happen with him? You know, is he going to be a problem in the locker room? Is he going to be sending out some messages from someone else's phone? You know, so different issues than Kyrie, but this proved to be a culture that he could hit a reset button with. And now he hasn't been in the league as long as Kyrie. There is a little bit more of like, oh, he's young, we'll be willing to forgive him for those things. But this proved to be a culture that could embrace him and help him be able to catapult and reset his career. Potentially, you know, and that's a player that didn't have the big shot that Kyrie did. So potentially this is proving to be the kind of team and culture that can do that for guys. And if they can do that for Kyrie, the reputation of this team as being one that can be a fixer, be a reset, that's huge. That's huge for them.
Also, I think the answer to your question, Chris, of like who's going to have to adjust the most is an answer that we're not going to have. Is an answer that we're not going to have for 12 more months because it's Kevin Durant. He's not only having to adjust to his own body as it will be after he's recovered from the Achilles, but he's going to have to adjust to playing with Kyrie. Like those are the two guys. That is the traditional discussion we have in the NBA, right? When two stars come together who haven't played together before, especially if they're both ball dominant or you know high usage guys, how are they going to fit together? It's an answer we won't have for a while. But if the guys who are here right now for this season that Kyrie will start off with, you know. Yes, Spencer Dinwiddie will handle a little less, but he already played with D'Angelo. Caris LeVert will handle a little less possibly, but he already played with D'Angelo. Like, I feel like there is no one person who's going to have to like seriously accommodate. They're all going to have to figure out each other, but I think they're fine. Like, I don't think this should be that hard.
And Sarah, like, all the people out here are ticket holders. They're fans of the Nets, but
I don't want to say this
canceled.
Check.
Oh. Yeah. Nope, we're all canceled.
Hello?
Check.
I don't think I'm still
on. Hello?
They're all off.
Is that a sign?
Check, check, check.
Good, good. Check. Oh, here we go again. All right.
Hello?
We're back up. We'll edit that out of the podcast. I don't want to say that this season doesn't matter, but does it? Like, anything... as long as there's not some kind of Boston-like meltdown in the locker room, everything's different in 2020, 2021. I mean, Kyrie Irving obviously wants to play with Kevin Durant. Their closeness is why we're all here right now in Brooklyn. I mean, what is a successful season to you?
I don't know if you'd put a exact, whether it's a number of wins, whether it's where you're getting in the postseason, but I would say from outsiders looking in, there was probably that perception in many cases the past few years in that 21 win season to the 28 win season, that it's probably, oh, what does that matter? 28 to 42 win. You could probably say the same type of things, and it mattered. Things mattered. And I think that goes back to why we talk about culture so much, the guys in the locker room. It matters to that. I guarantee you that whether they're talking about it or not talking about it now, they're starting to think about, okay, how do we take another step? How do we take another leap? Eventually, whether it's a year from now, 2 years, we have championship aspirations. So what do we do to continue laying the groundwork and foundation and understanding what it takes to not only win in the league, because we all know how tough that could be, but also those type of postseason experiences. And I think it was so valuable what they were able to do last year against Philadelphia and a lot of these guys getting that taste of playoff basketball for the first time. And I think it's going to be the same type of thing. And that's a great point about reintegrating Kevin Durant once he is eventually healthy. Next season, I think trying to figure out to get yourself together enough so when he does eventually come back, they will have the foundation set for how they're going to be able to incorporate him.
And, I mean, Howard, let me ask you this. You cover the Knicks for a number of years with the New York Times. The Nets have tried a bunch of different things to rival the Knicks. You know, some of it was goofy at the beginning with the billboards and, you know, the whole Jay-Z stuff and how they were attacking sort of a PR battle. Now they're the better team, like, by a lot. I mean, is that enough to make New York a Nets town? Does it take more than that? Is it generational? I mean, how do you, as someone that's covered both teams now, how do you answer that?
I think it's going to be generational. I mean, in this borough, you see tons of Nets gear, and yet, you know, I don't remember what polling I'd seen, or it was somebody's, you know, a Google heat map or something, but like the vast majority of NBA fans in Brooklyn were still Knicks fans, not Nets fans. They haven't been here long enough. I mean, it's been 7 years, and part of that has been just a pure rebuilding. So, you know, you can't do it overnight. Look, the Clippers just went through a 5-year span where they were by far and away the better team in LA. And yet the Clipper following in LA is still a tiny, tiny fraction of the Lakers. Now, the Lakers also have a bunch of banners that the Knicks don't have. And the Lakers haven't been nearly as dysfunctional and doing all the other things that, you know, could possibly piss off their fans. But the fact is, these are entrenched. These are trends and loyalties that are entrenched over generations and decades. It's gonna take a while, I think. So yes, the Nets are the better team right now and will be, I think, for the foreseeable future. And I have no faith that the Knicks are gonna figure it out anytime soon. That said, people still foolishly follow them and spend their money on them, and you know, it'll be interesting. I do think that kids who are growing up, and there's several in the crowd today who are growing up, especially if they're in this borough, like having Brooklyn across your chest or on your hat is different, and it feels more like a stronger connection. And if they grow up as Nets fans, you know, that's when you'll see it. You know, it's going to be, I think, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, and then their kids will grow up as Nets fans. And if this franchise continues to do things smartly and succeeds, and the Knicks keep doing what the Knicks do, who knows? Maybe there's a turning point there somewhere.
All right. Well, Sarah's got to go. She's got a broadcast to prepare for, but we'll take her mic and actually take a couple of questions from you guys out there before we are joined by Sean Marks.
Hi, Sarah.
So if anybody has any questions at all, there you go. Grab the mic.
How y'all doing? Thanks for all that y'all doing with us. So I think success for the Brooklyn Nets this season would be developing the mindset that we can do this without Kevin Durant. And if they hit the playoffs like that, guns are blazing, it's possible they can make the conference finals. I'm not saying they go to the finals, but just want to know your thoughts about that.
When Sarah was talking earlier about what is a successful season for this team, I do think that when you're listening to these guys at training camp and they're talking about what their expectations are, Kyrie has made it from his perspective very clear that he doesn't want to rush Kevin back. And what couples with that is that they are trying their best not to look at Kevin like in 2020 he is the savior of this franchise, right? Because then that puts some mounted expectations on his comeback that they're kind of trying to avoid. So in that sense, your assessment's probably correct, that they're trying to lay that foundation so that he can take his time getting back as opposed to the future of this franchise riding on Kevin's shoulders. That being said, there's a reasonable expectation that this team is going to be much better with Kevin Durant. The thing that is kind of in the back of everyone's mind, though, is an Achilles injury is serious. And until recently, it was an injury that not a lot of people came back from. And so what sort of player is going to show up? What kind of Kevin Durant is going to show up after a serious injury like that? He should be able to, you know, continue to do the fundamentals that he's done well without, you know, putting too much extra stress on that Achilles. But there's a balance there between trying to make him feel comfortable and not rushed, but also knowing that this is going to be a very different team when he's on the floor.
Okay, I could make the conference finals, sure. Wide open conference, you know, Philly, new team kind of put together. I hate to be that guy,
no.
But I was too
no.
I was too close to it last year. Just don't become Boston. Like, don't develop that trash of a locker room that they had at the end of last season. I believe everything that was set up here earlier in the pod, where guys are in different positions, there's no Terry Rozier looking for a contract, there's no Jalen and Jason coming off like being, you know, one shot away from advancing to the NBA Finals. But Kyrie's got to show me. He's got to show me that he wants to be a leader and be a guy that wants to be a great teammate and teacher to a Dinwiddie and to a Caris LeVert. If they get through this season, if this season ends in the exact same way as last season did, with that measure of positivity,
oh, yeah, no, that's
Bucks
a disaster.
Did, win. Throw a parade. Have a big parade down the street. Big win. Because here comes Kevin Durant down the aisle in 2020.
No, down the aisle, like
whatever.
Like they're waiting
he's
with
marrying
their veil
the team. All right,
end.
That's what he's doing.
Da, da, da.
Basically.
I think they just have to just make steady progress. I don't even think, like, nobody is expecting with a year-long wait for Kevin Durant that just because you won the offseason that you're going to be expected to make this massive leap to get to the conference finals or the finals. Like, everybody understands what it will be when Durant is back and if KD looks like the old KD. But until that moment arrives, you've simply upgraded from D'Angelo Russell to Kyrie Irving. You've got another year of growth from some of your young guys. You get a full year of health from Caris LeVert, and you make that steady progress. And if they could threaten somewhere in the high 40s and maybe even try to crack 50 wins and maybe, you know, a little more noise in the playoffs, that's a pretty solid season. And then you can look forward to what it means when Durant comes back.
Your bars are a lot higher than mine at this point. Mine are like...
Oh, I'm not saying that's reasonable. I'm saying that there's a best case scenario there, especially because after the top two teams in the East, it's really a jumble.
Yeah. All right, we'll take one more question. We see Sean Marks in the building, so we'll take one more question and get out.
How you doing? I'm a season ticket holder, and I wanted to address this being a Knick town. Definitely a Knick town. And I also believe that generation will help it. But in 2011, nobody rooted for Golden State. The whole country roots for Golden State now. The bottom line is winning. You win championships, this will become a Brooklyn town. You don't win championships, the fight gonna continue and it will be generational. But if you win, this will become a Brooklyn town.
Is that a question or a statement?
No, I would counter that by saying that yes, if you're successful and you win, they will follow. But Howard knows this well. There are Knicks fans that just follow the awfulness. Like, yeah. They still go and show up when they're bad or when they're mediocre. Those are the... Right, no, you're right.
Yeah.
You will absolutely establish fans that way, but you need fans that kind of stick with you through thick and thin. That's the younger people in this crowd that are growing up as young Nets fans there.
Well, and also, as an Oakland native... That team was easy to root for. I mean, when you're when the Warriors started to kind of heat up and the personalities they have, and the Nets have that potential here, right? They have those good guys that it's easy to root for, or you can root for the dysfunction. But like you said, it's two sides of the scale.
Which does happen.
It's kind of more fun to root for the dysfunction sometimes.
It's hard to believe it was 7 years ago that I wrote this story, but 7 years ago when the Nets first arrived, and I was at the New York Times, and I did a story about Knicks fans who were abandoning the Knicks for the Nets, because at that time, the Knicks had just thrown Jeremy Lin overboard. They were doing all their usual nonsense, and there were Knicks fans who were converting to Nets, and some of them were because they lived in Brooklyn already anyway, and they were NBA fans. That was 7 years ago, and you still see it now. There's enough discontent there, and especially the last several waves of it, and now they've thrown Porzingis overboard. There's a definite opening. I still think it's really hard for people to just flush years of loyalty to a team, but it does happen, and I do think there is another inflection point here where, with these guys on the rise and potential to be really great once KD is back, and the Knicks still... As I say, doing what the Knicks do, yeah, there's an opening.
All right. Howard Beck from Bleacher Report, Malik Andrews from ESPN. Follow these guys on Twitter. Read their stuff on ESPN.com and Bleacher Report. Thanks for joining me, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. When we come back, Sean Marks. All right. Joining me now on the podcast, entering his fourth full season with the Nets, the man responsible for everything you're going to see on the floor this year and beyond, Sean Marks, the general manager of the Nets. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
I was playing a game with the guests earlier about, you know, back in 2016 when you first took the job midseason, you know, would anyone have believed that they would have been? I want to go a little further back with you because in 2016, before you took this job, you were working with the Spurs, a great organization. If history is any guide there, jobs would have become available to you given that we've seen Sam Presti and Dennis Lindsay guys make that jump. You decided to take this job, a job that a lot of people looked at as kind of a dead end for a while because of all the assets that they gave away in recent years. What was it that gave you the mindset that you said, I'm going to take this job?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good question. I think there's a variety of different reasons why this job was really appealing to me. First and foremost was the market. You know, it's very rare that you get to choose or have the opportunity to run a team in a top five market in the world, you know, let alone the States. So to be coming to this market, to the New York Brooklyn market, that was great. Ownership at the time was slightly different, obviously, and that was a big reason why I wanted to be here. They gave me what I wanted to hear in terms of run this, how you see fit and so forth. And I think we were all in alignment on that part. And, you know, I was able to come in with somewhat of a clean slate and, you know, hire the right people I thought, you know, that fit the job, fit the challenge. We knew it was going to be difficult. We knew this was going to be a challenge, but I didn't want to be around naysayers. I didn't want to be around people that said, oh, no, it can't be done. I wanted to be around people who said, look, I got a chip on my shoulder. I want to show people, hey, look, I can figure this out. We can do it together. And essentially, that's what we're still trying to do to this day. It's a we. It's not me, that's for sure.
So, but in your position, what are your priorities at that point, going into that summer of 2016? The draft picks are gone for a little while. I mean, what are the first steps on rebuilding the foundation?
Yeah, well, we knew, you know, we were going to be somewhat, you know, hands tied behind our back a little bit, but it was going to be, you know, set the course, set the trajectory of where we wanted to be, and that started with the people. So the people that we brought in, the people that we hired from day one, high character people, again, competitive individuals, and that started with Kenny. So and you know, the dominoes fall from there. We knew we were not picking one, two, or three in the draft, so therein lies, you know, the rub again, where you said, look, well, what can we change here? And the only thing we could really do was put our hands on the culture. So the culture, the fit, the hires that were made, they have our fingerprints all over. And now it's just continue to evolve from there, where it's not one culture driver. Everybody's driving it. And that makes my job a little bit easier, and it makes everybody's job easier because they all have ownership in it.
We were talking earlier about how you kind of got here to the summer where you were able to sign Kevin and Kyrie, and you know, it on paper it kind of looks like a plan, like let's have that max cap space, the double max available. At the same time, you did some things over the last few years that if they had worked out maybe wouldn't have the cap space, whether it's Tyler Johnson, the contract, Otto Porter. I mean, how much of it in your mind is, you know, good things kind of happened that you didn't, maybe things you didn't plan for that created this opportunity?
Yeah, well, you're right, you're never gonna be able to plan for everything. I think something, you know, along the lines was, look, if we were going to go after Otto Porter or Tyler Johnson or whomever, the plan B was a pivot. It wasn't like, well, let's just go spend the money elsewhere.
That's not tampering, right, anymore? You're just saying players' names. That's no longer. That's okay.
But, you know, you just got to be careful with, like, you know, what you set out to do and, you know, your plan A, B, and C, and then not deviate from that too much, but make sure there is a plan B and a C, and it's not a scramble for, oh my gosh, this didn't work out. Now who are we spending money on, or how are we going to go about it?
What were you thinking? I mean, the way it's played out now, everything looks great. But you go back to December of last year when this team was scuffling a little bit. Karis goes down. It looks like, you know, a lot of people were writing two things, really. They were writing, will the Nets, who finally have their draft pick, start to tank? And is Kenny Atkinson's job in trouble? Did any of those thoughts cross your mind during that stretch?
Well, I think we were, you know, we never used the word tanking. So, and Kenny and I talk about a lot of things, but going in that direction, that's just really not in our DNA. That's not who we are. I don't think that's fair to the players that we brought in. I think the guys that came in wanted to compete and wanted to compete at the highest level. And as I've sort of said before, they've dictated how we've gone here. When they come out with preseason predictions on, you know, last year we want to make the playoffs and so forth, it's, well, who am I to say no? You know, if that's going to be their chip on their shoulder and that's what they're striving for, it's like, great, let's give them every single thing possible in this environment in order for them to succeed and so forth. So, look, there were definitely some dark days. There's no question of that. But again, I give Kenny a lot of credit here because, you know, right through the whole thing, he kept saying, look, it's going to turn. Trust the work, trust the process that we've put through here, the work that these guys have put in. And look, at that point, he was absolutely right, because the sweat equity that we talk about from the coaching staff and all the people behind the scenes, whether it's performance team and so forth, they believed. And whether there was a will or a way, they figured it out.
Trust the process, kind of a scary word, though, scary phrase. You know, that trust the...
Well, we don't use it in the same way as that.
Take me back to the end of the season last year, and you're in a position where you know you got a little bit of cap flexibility, but you've got a really good player in D'Angelo Russell coming up on free agency. When do you start to think about what actually played out with Kyrie and Kevin Durant?
Yeah, that goes back to kind of what I mentioned before, having those, you know, option A, B, and C. And, you know, sometimes there's an A and there's a 1A and so forth. But, you know, again, that's the benefits of restricted free agency. You know, when you have a restricted free agent, you know, time is a little bit more on your side. You get to make the determining factor of whether you want to match those deals or you want to get out ahead of it and you want to offer a deal. And for us, it was a matter of like, look, you know, we know D'Angelo really well. You know, he was great and still is and terrific while he was here. And for us, it was like, look, let's see what the other options are.
When you are evaluating Kyrie, and this is going to be something people watch all season long after what happened last season in Boston, what kind of homework do you do in a situation like that to figure out if your situation will be better than the one that he just left behind?
Yeah, look, I don't even know if I would just lump that on Kyrie. I would say we do this with everybody. We do this with staff members. So, you know, when we're hiring somebody who is going to have any interaction whatsoever with our players, you know, it's, I mean, everybody out here that has a job and has a background check, like, trust me, they did one on me. They do it on everybody. So it's important for us to get a feeling of how can we make it successful, you know, and what does that player or staff member or whoever need to succeed in this environment? What do they need around them? You know, our culture seems to be heading in one direction, but we know our culture is driven and our culture has to shift and change along the way here with the people that we bring in it. And, you know, it is constantly evolving. Everybody says, oh, well, your culture's done. It's not done. Like, there's no way. You know, these, you know, they're not even millennials, Generation X and so forth. I mean, it's changing constantly and we need to keep up with that. We need to keep up to speed with that.
When you're thinking about Kyrie, how useful is a player like Spencer Dinwiddie in a situation like that? A guy that obviously has a relationship with him that might be able to give you some insight as someone that's already on your roster.
Well, you know, those are one of those things we can't talk about anymore.
Okay, all right. All right.
But I will.
I forget the rules keep changing.
Yeah, but all I'll say is this. Like, you know, again, it's a players-driven league. It has been for quite some time now. So embrace it. Figure it out. These guys are smart young men. I mean, you know what Spencer's all about on and off the court. So they're going to be recruiting guys. I can't help that. Maybe they're recruiting guys that, you know, potentially aren't a fit, but they're going to be recruiting guys, and they're going to be spreading the word of, you know, how we do things here, what our culture is, what our environment is, what our system is, how Kenny is to play for, and so forth. So I don't think we shy away from, you know, any of that.
It's like when Tim Duncan recruited you, right? It's same thing in San Antonio.
I was lucky to hang on there.
What's your best Tim Duncan story?
You know what? There's too many Tim stories, and a lot of the stuff behind the scenes that he did, just to show how humble he was, is absolutely amazing for a guy of that stature. You know, one of the top, you know, 5-10 players of all time, and the humility that he displayed without really saying a word was remarkable. I can remember a couple instances where, you know, Pop came over and talked to Tim, and, you know, I was in earshot. I was rebounding for him, or his practice dummy, or whatever it was at the time, and told him, hey, look, Tim, I'm going to give it to you in this video session we're about to have. You're going to hear it from me. And I'm looking at myself going, you know, Tim had 35 and 16 last night. Like, what on earth is he going to tell him? Like, and sure enough, we go in there, and he shows two clips of Tim not getting an offensive rebound or not, you know, boxing out or something, and the message wasn't for Tim. The message was for 14 other guys in the room. So, and it's amazing that Tim put himself in those positions and embraced it.
Do you need that from your stars to, I mean, that's unique, I think, to have a Pop and Tim type of relationship. But do you need to be able to, you know, go at your stars like that to be successful?
I think you need to be able to have the relationship with all your players that they trust you, that it's not just coming out of left field. It's coming from a good place. You're coming saying, hey, look, there's a message here I need to send. Or, you know, guys want to be held accountable. Guys want to be coached. And it goes both ways. Like, if we're doing something, you know, around the gym or the environment that our players may not agree with, they have free rein to come in and say, Sean, hey, how about we do it this way? Or, you know, the food or the plane or the travel or the hotels, whatever it may be, like, you know, we'll at least listen and we'll tell them why we think this or we think that. And it's educating on both sides.
The worst Greg Popovich ever yelled at you was when?
That is definitely something that's not, this is PG, what, right?
Like, I mean, there are kids here, so I don't know that you can.
Yeah. Look, I like everybody else, respect Pop so much, and honestly, very little of it has to do with the coach that he is, and he's arguably the greatest coach ever, but it's the person, it's the man, it's the care factor that went in, again, behind the scenes. It's the relationships that he took so much time to develop with your kids, your wife, your significant other, your dad that traveled all the way from New Zealand, whatever it may be, he went out of his way, and that was special.
Do you impart any of that on Kenny? I mean, obviously he's his own man and doing his own thing, but he's also a young coach in this league. Do you have that type of conversation with him?
Yeah, look, I think Kenny and I have a very open relationship, which is great. You know, he can tell me how he's feeling and vice versa. I think at the end of the day, I have to embrace what Kenny is and who he is. He's emotional. He's passionate. He is the hardest working guy. So again, it's believable, you know, and he knows his faults. I think when you come across a person that says, look, I can be better here, that's humbling. And I think that relates to players. It relates to all of us. If we all came in here thinking we knew everything, well, I certainly wouldn't be here, and Kenny wouldn't be where he is. So the fact is, you've got to be curious. You've got to be constantly striving for, you know, how can I not only better myself, but better the people around me.
So everybody in this room is going to get a look at Kyrie Irving this season. Everybody's excited about that, of course. Kevin Durant, not until the following season. How big a risk do you think you're taking with a Kevin Durant? Obviously an incredible player, but a full season to recover, and history shows that next season back, maybe you don't get the player that you eventually get. And that type of injury, it's tough with a 7-footer it plays the way it does. I mean, how big a risk do you think it is?
Yeah, there's always risks. Everything we do, there's calculated risks, right? So I think in terms of Kevin, it is a matter of timing. It's a matter of an elite, top-tier talent, you know, wants to come, wants to be in Brooklyn, wants to be part of this. I've seen the way he's attacked his rehab. I've seen the competitor that he is. And that's paying dividends already just by our other guys being able to watch him on the sidelines and him going through his rehabilitation. You know, that's something that's motivating for us all, right? And, you know, when he steps out on the court and shoots a couple of buckets, you can hear a pin drop in there. So, you know, I think we embrace it. You know, I have no doubt that Kevin's going to do every single thing he can to succeed. And I think I'd be probably losing money if I bid against him, that's for sure.
Do you think you're going to hear from him mid-season with the, hey, I'm feeling great, man. You know, maybe maybe a month or two at the end.
Yeah, again, that's the competitor. It wouldn't surprise me, but again, what we had talked about earlier was just making sure we protect him from himself. You know, he's going to want to be out there. I know he wants to be out there with his guys. You know, obviously our performance team, what they've done in the past for other players has been nothing short of miraculous. They're up for the challenge. They want it. They've embraced a Kevin and vice versa. So, you know, it'll be a fun ride. It'll be a fun journey. Like all processes, there's ups and downs and so forth. But, you know, again, the risk in my mind was well worth taking.
All right, let me finish with this, because all these people that are here are ticket holders and excited about this season for sure. But it's weird, because the team that starts training camp next year will likely be a very different team with very different expectations. I mean, what are your expectations for this year? What do you hope comes out of it that you can take into the following season when Kevin returns?
Yeah, I think, well, the biggest thing I'm intrigued about is sort of the expectation as well. I love watching the camaraderie build. I love watching the relationships between the players and the players and staff start growing over time. And we've already seen it. That's what training camp's all about. So this is what our trip to China is going to be, just so invaluable for us. For when we go over there to, you know, a foreign land, we experience foreign things that are honestly life-changing experiences, and we're doing it together. You know, there was a travel party of, you know, 60 or 70 people, but for those 15 guys, 17 guys that are going to go over there and again have those experiences together, that's something that I'm intrigued about. The expectations are that they'll join in, they'll form a common bond, a very strong relationship, like we saw in last year's team, and it's like a snowball. It'll go from there.
Do you think, just to finish this, do you think that your young players know exactly what they're in for with Kyrie? Not the personality necessarily, but he is a great player who has been ball dominant for a lot of his career, and I mean, I saw firsthand in Boston some guys on the court just struggle with that. Yeah. I mean, how do you think your young guys who have been used to playing a certain way are going to adjust to that?
Yeah, I think there's probably an adjustment, you know, all around a little bit. But what we've all seen so far, the first sort of 5 days of camp, is Kyrie's leadership. And Kai has empowered Spencer Dinwiddie, encouraged Caris LeVert, got on Jared Allen, you know, patted DJ on the butt. Like, it's been all those conversations that they've all had. And it's twofold, right? Kyrie has been open enough to listen to Jared and Spencer and Carrot and Karis and so forth. So again, it's those relationships that are building over time, and they'll build behind the scenes, and then hopefully everybody here will see the product on the floor.
Well, Sean Marks, one of the most impressive turnarounds in recent memory. Good luck this season, and thanks for joining me here.
Cheers. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, man.